I believe God has spoken directly into my life, that I have a relationship with the God of the universe through Jesus Christ. And again, that's something very personal. It's not something I can necessarily prove to my non-Christian neighbor, but it's something that has made a profound difference for me. So there, I guess that is that head and the heart coming together there.
On In Good Faith, we believe that all faith traditions have something to teach us about how God is working in the world and in our lives. So join us as we listen and learn. Today on In Good Faith, we get to speak with a podcast host. Well, he's had a radio show. He has a book with the fabulous title, Unbelievable, which is both like, wow, I can't believe it. It's so wonderful. And I don't believe a bit of it. Mm-hmm. And it's all about discussions with Christians and atheists. I'm in studio today with two of our fabulous student producers, Leah King.
Hi, Steve.
Also, Aaliyah Ebert.
Hey, everyone.
And Justin really has interesting stories. First of all, I think you're going to love his accent. I don't know. People are 10% smarter when they have an English accent. I think that's how I feel. What really struck you about this, Leah?
Yeah, I loved his discussion on intellect and kind of how spirituality requires both our heart and our mind.
And I felt the same about many different guests. Some of them started intellectually, like, this kind of makes sense to me. Others started with the heart, like, I just have had an experience and I feel there is a God. But in the course of our life journeys, how the head and the heart, I think, most often have to combine to have a strong faith.
I also loved that he says that he's grateful for the atheist movement in the UK. I thought that was really interesting. So just listen for why he's grateful for it.
So with his new book, The Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God, and the whole idea that he thinks, I will start a podcast where I invite people who really hate what I believe to come and attack my beliefs. So, of course, that was my first question. Why?
I began really hosting conversations between Christians and non-Christians, nearly 20 years ago, believe it or not, when the Unbelievable show began, initially just as a radio show and then became a podcast, eventually a video show as well. And really, it was because I felt like, you know, as a Christian, I wanted to get out of my bubble a little bit. Mm. I wanted to hear from other perspectives. I wanted to hopefully model what good conversations are like. We live in a very secular, post-Christian kind of culture in the UK. And so I think it's really helpful, actually, for Christians to be challenged a little bit and to be modeled what a good conversation with a non-Christian friend or neighbor might look like. So that was really the purpose of beginning to host these conversations, which were challenging, you know, that not everyone enjoyed hearing their beliefs and deeply held views questioned by atheists and agnostics and people of other faiths. But actually, I think it was actually a really healthy thing to do because I found that Christianity could stand up on its own two feet intellectually. And if you haven't got a faith that can stand up to some questions, you've got to ask whether you've got a faith that's worth defending. So for me, it was a really helpful thing to do in the long run.
Do you like the word apologetics, or is that not what you consider what you do?
I tend to avoid the term if it's the first time I'm interacting with someone or someone who might mistake me for thinking it's something like apologizing for something, saying sorry for something. It's a useful technical term, which simply means the intellectual defense of faith. But I would more often perhaps use a word like defending the faith, explaining the faith, giving evidence, Christian persuasion. That perhaps means a little bit more to most people than this rather strange word, apologetics. But I think apologetics as such is a very useful, helpful thing. It certainly helped me as I've thought through my faith. I think it's quite important for a number of people as they put the pieces together. They need that kind of an intellectual, rational approach. It doesn't negate the need for also personal experience, of course. And I think in the end, faith is about both the head and the heart coming together. But I think for many people, they do need that rational approach to help just put pieces together, though it's never just one or the other in the end.
In your experience, are there people who maybe have actually had the heart part and felt something, but have been talking themselves out of it because they didn't have anything intellectually to latch onto that made sense?
Yeah, I think that's quite right. And to some extent, that's a little bit what my journey was initially, because I very much had an experience of God that brought me to faith in my sort of mid-teens. But I think my intellectual side had to catch up with that because I wasn't specifically in a church that really dealt that much with the intellectual case for faith. So by the time I got to university, there were plenty of skeptics and atheists ready to challenge my new faith. And I was so glad when I did start to read thinkers like C.S. Lewis and started to discover what I later discovered was called Christian apologetics. And that really helped to make intellectual sense of some of those things that I'd felt at a kind of a gut level, a very kind of experiential level deep down. So, and I think that's probably the way it operates for a lot of Christians. I don't think that all of that many necessarily come to faith through very kind of rationalistic ways. It's very often an experiential thing. But you do need to have those reasons in place ultimately, because you are going to be asked to make a defense of your faith to others in the end. And that's where I think apologetics can be very helpful.
Yeah. When Paul says, be ready, that sort of says, this will be coming. And you should think about this before it happens.
Yeah, absolutely.
Are you comfortable telling me about that experience when you were younger? What made you feel like you had experienced God in some way?
I suppose my story is perhaps not dissimilar to many people, because I was raised in a Christian family. And so church going and so on was part of my background. But I don't think I'd ever really grasped or latched onto that faith for myself. It was sort of inherited really from my parents up to those sort of mid-teenage years. And then I went away on a youth camp for a long weekend with my youth group at the time. And I was very grateful for the presence of those peers of mine and some great youth leaders. And there was just one particular evening when everything came together and I was sort of challenged to take this seriously. And I guess I can only describe it as the lights coming on. And I had a very sort of, quite intense, I would say, experience, what I would call an experience of the Holy Spirit, really, sort of suddenly just becoming aware of God's extraordinary love for me and his grace and his goodness. And suddenly, what had seemed like a sort of something I did because it was sort of what my family did became very personal to me. It really was a sort of, I was one of those people who had a kind of a road to Damascus moment. I can kind of give you the time and the place and the date where the lights came on. That's obviously not the experience of everyone. My wife is someone for whom it was far more of a slow dawning awareness of her faith. But the point is, as C.S. Lewis has this sort of analogy of the person who is on a train from Paris to Berlin, and the person who travels by daylight perhaps knows the exact moment they cross the line between France and Germany. The person who takes the sleeper train begins in Paris and wakes up in Berlin. But the point is, you've arrived at the same destination, even if you can't give an exact moment. That's my story. There are people who have different stories to that, but that was my experience of coming into the faith, at least.
You've already answered part of my next question, which was, do those early apologetics like C.S. Lewis hold up today?
They do.
And what you've just told me is as relevant.
Yeah. Well, the fact I've already referenced him a couple of times suggests that you know that I'm a bit of a fanboy of C.S. Lewis. But yeah, I continue to read Lewis today. And if anything, he seems more relevant now than he did when I first started reading him. And there are very few people that I just always recommend to people. But C.S. Lewis is one of them, you know.
So this title, The Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God, tell me first about that phrase and then why you wanted to talk about it.
Well, I had been hosting these conversations between Christians and atheists for some time, really beginning in the mid-2000s. And that was a time when the new atheism was really the big thing. These very high-profile atheist figures denouncing God publicly through best-selling books like Richard Dawkins' The God Delusion. I remember the atheist bus campaign in London when Red London buses bearing the slogan, "There's probably no God, now stop worrying and enjoy your life." These were circulating the capital. And it was just very trendy, you know, to be an atheist, to kind of dismiss religion. And the mantra of this was the idea that God was a fairy tale and religion was bad for you. And that was the kind of the driving force, really, in our culture around the whole God question and the conversation in culture. So that was very much the environment in which my unbelievable show was born. And I hosted lots of those kinds of debates and dialogues between these quite strong new atheist figures and Christian thinkers on the other side. And that was quite exciting and dramatic. You know, it was an interesting time to be having that kind of conversation. And in many ways, I'm very grateful to figures like Richard Dawkins, because I think, in a strange way, they actually put the God question back on the public table, really. They made people who were probably fairly apathetic, if anything, towards God here in the UK, start to ask questions again, which I was grateful for. But it was a very dismissive, quite arrogant approach to God.
Yeah.
And the big difference for me was that as time went on over the following years, there was a real change in the tone of the conversation. And so I noticed more and more people who came on my show who were not necessarily Christians, but they didn't want necessarily to be associated with New Atheism either, because they felt it had become very shrill and dogmatic and dismissive. So they would say, I'm not a Richard Dawkins kind of atheist. And likewise, I started to see more and more sort of problems developing in this New Atheist movement. There were a lot of infighting that started to happen, a lot of disagreement. And in the end, it sort of began to unravel in all kinds of interesting ways, because once they had agreed that God didn't exist and religion was bad for you, they really couldn't agree on much else beyond that. And the movement really got riven by arguments over the culture wars, gender, sexuality, all those sorts of things. As I saw the New Atheism start to fade away, both because of these internal issues and just the sense that it hadn't really answered people's fundamental existential questions about life, I saw this interesting new conversation developing, still with secular intellectuals, non-Christians, but who were just taking faith far more seriously. And more I was featuring voices who were far more sympathetic to the value of faith, who were far more open to giving credence to Christianity and the gifts it had given the West. And then a very interesting sort of phenomenon really emerged sort of 2017, 2018, which was what I've termed the Jordan Peterson phenomenon, this rather eccentric Canadian psychologist yes. who suddenly uh-huh. appeared on the scene, drawing large crowds of young men, thousands, attending these three-hour lectures on the book of Genesis, of all things. And I began to ask myself, what's going on here? Because these were essentially the same demographic who had been turning up for the New Atheists. And yet here they were, coming to listen, sit at the feet of this sort of, yes, secular psychologist, but who was pointing them back towards the Bible and saying, we've sort of maybe thrown the baby out with the bathwater when we've rejected the Christian story. Maybe there's something of value here. So I was noticing more and more of these figures popping up. And it just seemed to me that God had come back into the conversation. People were taking Christianity seriously again in all kinds of ways. And I started to put this together into a phenomenon that I sort of gave the label, the surprising rebirth of belief in God, because it was rather surprising to hear God and faith being taken seriously again, often in these secular non-Christian circles. And I was also noticing just lots of surprising stories of adult converts to faith, people who were themselves very surprised to find that they believed the Christian story, that it suddenly seemed to make sense of them. I bumped into enough of these things, I suppose, anecdotally, and just got a sense of the real change in the tone of the conversation that I wanted to put that down in a book form, which I did, and that got published last year. And then that led on to the podcast documentary series, which is just a deeper dive into some of these characters and the way I think the conversation on God has changed quite dramatically in the last 5 to 10 years.
Because you've been in this ongoing conversation for decades, there must have been some things that really challenged you faith-wise, because you have been so open and haven't shied away from difficult questions, and then other things that must have really built faith. And I wonder if you'd comment on either or both of those. What's been challenging and what really made you feel you had an anchor somewhere?
Well, certainly a lot of the issues that I covered over the course of hosting these conversations over many years certainly challenged me. I was often exposing myself to objections to Christian faith that I just hadn't even thought of before, you know, but then as you sort of put yourself in the firing line when you invite atheists and agnostics.
You'd be unprepared.
Yeah, yeah. Or at least there would be issues I hadn't really looked into in any great detail. So I remember, for instance, when I first had Bart Ehrman on, who's quite a well-known critical New Testament scholar, and he had this best-selling book, Misquoting Jesus, where he questioned the sort of historicity of the transmission of the New Testament documents and whether we can really know we've got the original words of Jesus and so on. And when you read his book first time round, you know, it's quite challenging. You wonder, can we trust, you know, the New Testament documents and so on? And I can remember, you know, one or two sleepless nights once I'd invited him on, read the book, and I thought, gosh, how is this going to go? But then I invited on one of the UK's best New Testament scholars, Peter J. Williams, to come on opposite him for that show from Cambridge. And you immediately see, once you've got someone on the other side who absolutely knows the material just as well as Bart Ehrman, that there's always two sides to every story. So that was just one example where certainly there was a challenge, but I felt a good response. And certainly it's not as though my faith has remained exactly the same through all of these issues as I've come across them and dealt with stuff. Sometimes I've had to slightly change the way I think about scripture, for instance, and I've had to take on board a more nuanced approach to the way it is. But I've come out of it feeling actually I've got a much greater depth of understanding and appreciation for just how extraordinary the scriptures are, in fact, while also recognizing that they have this particular historical background and you have to take that seriously in the way in which they have been written down and passed on to us and everything. So that's just one example where there have certainly been challenges along the way. And I could list many other similar things where I had to maybe think carefully through issues around salvation and hell, creation and evolution, where, you know, I didn't necessarily maybe know exactly what I believed when I started out as a young 25-year-old, but I came to positions as I heard both sides and was able to make my own mind up on these things. I mean, in the end, as I say, I do feel like my faith was actually really strengthened, though, in the process of doing that. And I think that's the overall thing that I've really appreciated from nearly 20 years of hosting these kinds of conversations, is that Christianity does have this extraordinary, strong historical core to it. It really is about a set of claims about a person who really lived in a time and place. And it stands or falls on this claim of this person who lived, died, and his followers said came back to life again. And I find actually that when you kind of get down to that central core of it, there's an extraordinarily good amount of evidence that what they said happened really did happen. And for me, I've always wanted to hear the best of both sides and hear the objections. But I find in the end that Christianity just has the most compelling story on offer. It just speaks to me both at an intellectual, historical, philosophical, but also emotional and experiential level. It for me is the most compelling story of reality. And that's been hugely encouraging.
This is In Good Faith. I'm Stephen Cap Perry. We'll be back with more in just a moment. Welcome back to In Good Faith. We're chatting with Justin Brierley about facing challenges to our faith and a surprising rebirth of belief in God.
As you've seen this change in society, this resurgence or rebirth, as you call it, of belief in God, what effect does that, has that, or could it have on our society?
The first thing to say is I can imagine a lot of people scratching their heads and saying, what rebirth? Because if you just look at the statistics, you know, especially here in the UK or in other parts of the West, the church has been in decline for a long time. And I don't in any way deny that. In fact, in the book, I spell out those statistics in some detail, that we've got the rise of secularism, decline in church going, more and more people saying they're non-religious, they're nuns, as in N-O-N-E-S, nuns. And all of that is true. We live in a very post-Christian age. And to some extent, I think the US is only a decade or so behind that curve in some ways. I think you're seeing now, especially among Gen Z, younger age, kind of less and less kind of religiosity. So you may say, well, why are you talking about a resurgence or a rebirth of belief in God? And I think at one level, what I'm describing is really about a change in the way people are talking about God now, in those sort of intellectual circles, in our culture. And at that level, I don't think we may see the effects of that till some way down the line. But what I am seeing alongside all of this is, as well as these interesting conversations and going on in sort of intellectual circles, I think we're experiencing a real moment of a meaning crisis in Western culture. And this is what a lot of psychologists are saying. As we've lost the Christian story in the West, which once gave people essentially a sense of their meaning, their purpose, their identity, it's created a void. And in a way, the new atheists thought they could come along and fill that void with science and reason, and this would give people their purpose. But it didn't. Science and reason are good for some things, but they won't give you a meaningful life. That's not what they're there for. And so what's rushed into this void is all kinds of other quasi-religious stories of reality, really. And on the right, you might see, you know, certain political mythologies around savior figures in politics. That becomes their sort of new religion. And you've seen the rise of identity politics around sexuality and gender. And that kind of becomes some people's sacred thing. That becomes their god, their idol almost. You see, we're made to live in a story. And if we don't have the best story, the original story, if you like, we'll find a different story to live for. But the problem is, of course, this just is only sort of accelerated by technology, social media, smartphone addiction. All of that, I think, is rushing together in this moment to create a real problem in our culture in terms of the culture wars, the rise in mental health problems, especially among young people. But it's also, I think, creating the conditions for people to start taking faith seriously again, to kind of maybe look back to the God story. And this is where I see the kind of bubbling up of a kind of spiritual hunger and thirst as people have tried to find meaning and purpose on their own terms and through these other stories. But they're coming up empty. And I just see increasingly, especially among that younger generation, just the first signs of this surprising rebirth actually happening from the ground level. And I think it's fascinating when I see statistics like just recently in Finland, of all places, very secular, post-Christian, atheistic kind of country. And I think it was between 2016 and 2019, there was more than doubling of young men attending church, praying, belief in God among that demographic. And that's the last demographic you would think that would happen to. Likewise, there's just been pockets of sudden surges in Gen Z sort of coming alive to faith. And I've seen pockets of that happening all over the place. And new research on Gen Z is showing that they're the most open of any generation yet to God. And I just wonder if we're going to start to see something shifting quite soon. I don't know for sure. I'm not very good at predicting the future, but I just feel like something has changed in the atmosphere, and we're maybe just starting to see the first signs of that.
Well, you've put your finger on something really interesting, because when I speak with spiritual leaders, they so often say that the young people they meet are very spiritually interested, even if they're not coming or committing to a denomination. So I guess to be able to serve people and find meaning, it seems like there has to be some sort of community. Mm. In the past, that's been the Christian churches or a synagogue or a mosque. But yeah, I'd be so interested to see how people find community the way we used to measure
it. Yeah, I think that's the big question. And the problem is we're living in an age which has sort of encouraged individualism. I do think, though, I do get the sense that people are craving genuine community again. I think you get to a point where, as I say, the mental health crisis we're experiencing is partly a crisis of loneliness. And the church is still one of the few places where people get together on a regular basis to be together in person. And it's messy and it's complex and everything else. But actually, I think people are looking for a place like church, because at its best, the church is also a place where you find grace, forgiveness, a place where you're accepted, essentially, because we're all in the same boat. We know we're all sinners and we're all there because of the mercy of God. And I think that's very different to the culture many, especially young people, find themselves in, which can actually be very judgmental, even though it casts itself as being very tolerant and so on. If you don't measure up, you can be rounded upon. It's very...
You'll hear about
it. There's a cancel culture kind of mentality. It takes all the worst aspects of religion in a way. You know, it can be very puritanical in its own way. And I think that's partly why there is an attraction back to church for some people, because actually it's a place that just deals honestly with the human condition and hopefully gives you a place where you can share that journey with others. So I think God isn't finished with the church. And my hope and prayer is that we will see a revival of sorts as people come back to both God and to the vehicle he gave us to do his will on the earth.
Are you able to put your finger on why you believe?
Gosh, I would give two reasons why I believe. One of them involves the sort of thing I've been doing as a day job for many years, the apologetics answer, if you like, is that I really do believe that God is the best explanation of a whole set of data and evidence, if you like. I believe God makes sense of human existence, the fact we're here at all. I think it all points to some kind of divine mind behind the cosmos, behind us. I think God, if you like, makes sense of human value, the fact that we believe in human rights and equality and dignity. That has to come from somewhere beyond us, beyond nature. I believe God is the best explanation of human purpose and the fact that we have this transcendent search for meaning across all times, places, and cultures. It feels to me God is the right answer to that search. So there's lots of sort of pieces of data I could point to say that there are lots of reasons why I believe in God. But ultimately, also, it's because I believe God has spoken directly into my life, that I have a relationship with the God of the universe through Jesus Christ. And again, that's something very personal. It's not something I can necessarily prove to my non-Christian neighbor, but it's something that has made a profound difference for me. So there, I guess that is that head and the heart coming together there. That's what makes me a Christian today.
That was Steve talking with Justin Brierley. In the intro, I said to listen for why he's grateful for the atheist movement in the UK. And the answer was that it kind of put God on the map again. Then maybe we should take his existence a little more seriously as Christians. And something that really stuck out to me in this interview along those lines is that he said, if we have a faith that can't stand up to some questions, then we have to wonder if it's worth defending. And so I really loved that intellectual approach to faith.
Yeah, I loved that too. It reminded me of in high school, I took a sociology class and they had us all sign up for different panels. And I signed up for the religion panel. And there were like five of us and everyone else was like, yeah, I go to church on Easter or Christmas, or I'm atheist. I've never really been to church. And then I was like, I go to church every morning at 5 a.m. and I go every Sunday and I teach sometimes. I talk in our sacrament meeting. And everyone was kind of like, well, that's interesting. That's bizarre for this high school student to do. But I liked it. And I liked that that panel gave my peers an opportunity to ask me questions that otherwise we can't really ask in a school setting.
You know, and Justin Brierley talked about how when he first started, there was this big movement, sort of atheistic, and was the young men sort of college age that were sort of flocking to dismiss all of this. And then 20 years later, he finds that's the same group who is now going back to church or exploring and asking about God because of this search for meaning.
It's a search for meaning for sure. And he also mentions a search for community and friendship. He points to the mental health crisis and how people are often feeling lonely. I think it's so interesting. I never thought that church could be sort of a solution for that in building community and introducing people to each other.
And Justin says, the Christian story really holds up. That's what he discovered. And he was very, I think, kind and vulnerable to talk about as a youth having this Holy Spirit experience at a youth camp that just made him feel like, I need to explore the intellect and everything because I know I have had this experience with God. That's how I've often felt as a youth. Like, I don't understand all this. I can't explain it if people come at me, but I know I've experienced God in some way. Many thanks to Justin Brierley for speaking with us. This episode was produced by Heather Bigley. Our production team also includes Aaliyah Ebert, Leah King, Katarina Martinich, James Sturtevant, and Josh Orton. Our post-production sound designers are Mark Hansen, Lauren Sandberg, and Ashton Parkinson. In Good Faith is committed to the idea that we all benefit from hearing people of widely varying backgrounds share their personal experience with faith and belief. In fact, we think people with such experience deserve some of our best listening. We'd love it if you would leave a comment or a review wherever you get your podcasts and listen to us. That's Apple, Spotify, YouTube, wherever. That helps spread the word. Find us on Twitter at InGoodFaithPod, Instagram and Facebook, InGoodFaithPodcast. Our YouTube page is youtube.com/@in-good-faith. In Good Faith is a production of BYU Radio. I'm Stephen Cap Perry. I hope you join me again soon, right here in Good Faith.